My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? Frank Muir, to start with. Gallivant.
Gallivant?
Mm-hmm.
It means to stutter. It's a male thing. I don't think women gallivant. I don't know why. I think it means to strut about peacock fashion to impress the ladies.
Yes. Not necessarily in a straight line.
Well, gallivant, it means to sort of saunter lasciviously.
Yes. I think that's about as good a definition as you can get, and Frank gets his 2 marks. Anne Scott James has the next word, and it is mellifluous.
Well, it's always used of a voice. Never heard it used of anything else. Is the mel flowing like honey?
Yes.
Very sweet voice.
Yes, it needn't necessarily be voice, I think. It most normally is, I think,
Anne.
What
else could be mellifluous now?
Well, if you're a poet.
You always talk about mellifluous tones, don't you?
Yes, that's right. Mm. Music, it can be. Or poetry.
Mellifluous words, do you?
Yes.
Mellifluous.
Poetry.
A lyric poetry might be mellifluous.
Yeah, that's good now. It means sweet as honey or sweetly flowing, just as honey is supposed to flow, and it's normally used figuratively for, as Anne quite rightly says, for somebody's voice or their tone of voice, for tunes, for verses, and so on. 2 marks. Well, now, Dennis Norden. Cosmetic as an adjective.
As an adjective?
Mm-hmm.
As in you do a cosmetic job on somebody, you would
yes.
say. Yeah? It means prettied up. When royalty used to travel by train, they used to hang sort of rambling roses and trellis of flowers round the gents' sign on railway stations.
Wouldn't have helped.
So you would have a cosmetic gents, or you would have done a cosmetic job on the gents.
It wouldn't have helped Queen Victoria very much, I don't think.
Well, it would have been all right. Queen Victoria could have foreseen difficulties for Albert. But I mean, sort of politically, when they say we'll do a cosmetic job on the candidate, that means they wipe out all the records of how he beat his wife, and you know.
That's right.
I've got to have cosmetic surgery on my nose because I've got a lump on my nose, which is going to affect my writing because at the moment it supports my spectacles. They're going to go sideways. So that means to rectify a fault, isn't it?
I'd call that caricature rather than cosmetic. No, I think Dennis is quite right. The power to beautify, I think normally applied to the complexion or to the state of your hair, but also, as Dennis quite rightly says, superficial improvement of other things, including presumably members of Parliament. 2 marks. And Dennis Powell, yours is the last word in this round, and it is bombilious. Bombilious.
Bomb with a Y?
Yes, it has a Y, which...
Could we have an I instead? I mean, it isn't sort of the feeling of nausea you experience after eating a bomb.
M it is, rather than N, yes. Might be the feeling of nausea that would come if this rather noisy thing hit you sharply in the face.
It's a bomb, you lot.
Well, it's a buzz bomb.
An insect. It's one of those large beetles.
Well, not a beetle.
No?
No, not a beetle.
No.
It's very simple indeed.
Lepidopter.
Yes. No, if it buzzes at you, what is it normally?
A bee.
Yes. That's what I wanted.
It appertains, as they say in the dictionary. As you say dictionary definition, it appertains to a bee.
I'm going to give you 1 out of 2.
Oh. Oh.
It means buzzing or humming, like a large bee, and bombulios is the Greek for bumblebee. It is rather a nice name for it.
Well, is that why a bumblebee is called a bumble?
Yes, originally, yes. It comes from Greek. Yes.
I never thought, because they don't bumble. They're sort of crisp
charming,
in their action.
Yes. Nice creatures. Like them.
Well, now they know better. Well, for those who like to guess what the stories might be like, what, Frank, will be your quotation for later on in the last round of this programme?
There are fairies at the bottom of our garden.
Well, yes, that's fair enough. And Dennis?
Well, mine's nothing like as venerable as that. Mine is, once I had a secret love.
Once I had a secret...
Well, congratulations, we go on to the next round. And this is a round on fools, folly and foolishness. For 2 marks, who are the authors of the following anti-foolish sentiments, beginning again with Frank Muir? I always treat fools with great ceremony. True good breeding not being a sufficient barrier against them.
The clue here is true good breeding,
yes,
isn't it? Yeah. It, therefore, it's the chap who invented a overcoat and a small overstuffed sofa.
Quite right.
Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son.
Well done, Frank.
Or possibly his godson.
Yes, might have been that. I think it's letters to the son, natural son, I can't remember. Any rate, Philip Dormer Stanhope, Earl of Chesterfield in the 18th century. 2 marks, well done, Frank. And Scott James. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool.
Crackling thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool.
It's one of these old sententious books in the
Old
Testament.
Well, let's say it's the Old Testament. When we get a bit of that.
Let's say it's like the... Then you've got first or second half.
Oh, wait a moment. Not the Psalms. What's the one? Proverbs.
It's a little earlier than Proverbs.
Frank was making gestures at me. I've never yet known anything out of the Bible. He always mixes it up with Dickens.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to... Yeah.
Dennis might help you on this, I think.
He won't.
He won't.
It's the 7th chapter, verse 6.
You're absolutely right.
Of what?
Of course I'm right, I know.
That's a brilliant bit, I think. It is, in fact, Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, chapter 7, verse 6, as Frank quite rightly says. Uh-huh. Well, now, Dennis Norton. Almost all absurdity of conduct arises from the imitation of those whom we cannot resemble.
I don't
know.
Tragedy
in Austin.
Yes, it has an Austin ring, doesn't it? Oh.
Dr. Johnson?
Yes.
Oh.
Oh, well done.
We've been helping each other all the while. It's Dr. Johnson in The Rambler. And now Dillis Powell's turn. I'm always afraid of a fool. One cannot be sure that he is not a knave as well.
That takes us back, does it, Frank? Does it, Jack? It takes us back a little way from...
Takes you back about 170 years, I should say.
170, where are we now? That takes us to 1800.
Who have we got to be?
A little later, perhaps. 160, Scott? Perhaps.
Yeah. Ragtime.
Scott? He's not listening. Scott?
Scott.
No, he was a conspicuously English character, this one.
Well, probably Byron.
Oh.
No.
No, not Byron.
No, not Byron.
He had the effrontery to lecture on the English poets.
Yes. Hazlitt?
Yes. I think my help was fairly minimal, so I'll give you your 2 marks. So we come to round 3, which is a round of origins and derivations. And for 2 marks again, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? And we begin with Frank Miller. Frank, by and large.
By and large is...
probably nautical.
Yes.
It's when you... if you're... anybody who wants to take up boating thinks the first thing they must do is rent, and then something small. And any English boat builder will say, no, 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 buy and large. Could that possibly...
So far, the only thing Frank's got right is that it is actually nautical.
Well, it, by and large, it means all things considered, you know.
Yes, it does.
Looking at all aspects of everything, I would say, by and large. You know. So it's probably one of those sailing things.
That's where the present meaning, yes, that's fair enough.
Where they take everything into account, Jack, and by and large, he then aims there to get there.
Well, you crept through to 1.5 marks now. That's pretty good. It means to sail slightly off the wind and not close hauled, so giving the helmsman a certain manoeuvrability. It means literally to sail to the wind and off it. 1.5.
Uh-huh.
Well, now you know. And Scott James. Salmonella poisoning.
Well, it's a poisoning you get from eating tinned salmon, I think.
Needing the salmon, no.
Salmon-like fish.
Yeah, I'd leave that meaning of salmon. I'd leave right out of account.
Good heavens!
Salmonella. Oh. It was derived from the first two people who got it, who were a married couple called Samuel and Ella.
Well, you're so jolly near.
But it was. What was that marvellous film where the crew of the plane? There was a choice of two dishes for the, and the crew ate the one that gave everybody salmonella and had to go down the plane seeing who hadn't had this dish, and whoever that was then took the plane in. Yes, they did, by and large.
Probably called Angels 85
no,
or something.
No, salmon and Delilah.
Well, we think it comes from somebody's name, do
we? Yes, that's right. Stick to that one, and you're all right, Anne.
Ella Salmon.
Well, all right, stick to the salmon.
Salmon. His name was Salmon.
It wasn't salmon. Wasn't
Dr.
a female.
Salmon.
Yes. Mm. It was.
There we are. 2.5 marks.
No, 1.5.
What kind of dubious kind of immortality to have a food poisoning name?
Well, this is a particularly horrid one. It comes from the bacillus of hog cholera, named after Daniel Salmon, who was an American pathologist who first identified it and didn't himself die of it, as far as I know. 1.5. Dennis Norton, a tycoon.
Well, that's a really big wheel in business, you know.
Nowadays, yes.
Get me New York on 3. You know, I've never queried what it derives from. Is it a typhoon is a big noise, so, you know, it wouldn't be a corruption, because they are, by and large, corrupt.
That I would agree, but it doesn't help with the typhoon.
No, I don't think anything's going to help me with tycoon.
Somebody called Tycho.
Yeah, was it a Dr. Tycoon who first discovered...
Oil in America.
Yes, how to... bacillus of conglomeration.
Now, shift yourself across from the Atlantic to the Pacific and settle there for a moment.
Oh, yes, they have tycoons in the Pacific, don't they? They run shore.
They have a lot in the Middle East now.
No. Yeah.
Japan, China...
Yes.
Japan.
Oh,
that's right.
Oh, it was from Thai. It was a gentleman in Thailand, would it be?
No, Jap. Big business.
That's what we want, yes.
A big business... Yes, a big Japanese businessman, although they tend to be small. Like.
This was the biggest of the lot and not in business.
I don't know. The emperor.
Next to the emperor.
The crown prince.
No, you're forgetting...
The prime minister.
You're forgetting your bit of 19th century Japanese history.
So
oh,
I am.
Yes, how could
we
you?
Are.
Well, you are scatterbrained.
I'm going to give you one. It was the title by which the Japanese, when they were talking to foreigners who were inferior, described a character called the Shogun, who was in fact the real ruler of Japan during about a century or more than a century, in which the emperor was only a figurehead, and the chap who was really in charge was the Shogun. And for reasons best known to themselves, they wouldn't utter the word shogun to foreigners like ourselves, but called him tycoon. One out of two. To this power, pig iron.
Pig iron is a rather not quite useless form of iron. A rather sort of it's the beginning form of iron. It's before Bessemer got to work on it, then.
Well, yes, a little.
Bessemer mucho.
No, it's the sort of beginning of making iron into steel.
It is very much the beginning of making iron.
It's not been sort of shaped or formed.
That's right.
Lumps.
That's right.
Just lumps of iron.
What shape?
Pig-shaped.
I really have done my absolute level best.
Rectangular. It's in kind of blocks.
It's rectangular, that's quite.
Blocks.
That's better, yes. Why?
You're useless on mechanics.
Dennis, why does it come out that shape?
Well, that's the way the machine makes it.
I can't win. I'm going to give, for sure ingenuity, I'm going to give Dillis 1.5 marks. Iron, cast iron, used to be cast in oblong ingots, which are now called pigs. And rudely, they were originally called sows. And sow is now applied to the channel in which the molten iron runs. And then there are little bits, branches, which diverge from it. Each of them is called a pig, and it is rectangular. So you finish up with a very, very heavy bit of cast iron, which is called pig iron. And that brings us to the last round.
Oh.
And Frank and Dennis's quotations. And the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, your quotation, which comes from Rose Feilman's poem, Fairies, is, "There are fairies at the bottom of our garden."
It isn't very nice to catch anybody out, except a dentist, perhaps, but they never are, they're always in. But I have caught Dennis Norden out in something, and this is going to be a painful explanation for me as to how this came about. I mean, 28 years ago, when we first started writing together, we were very close indeed. We shared everything. We had a wife each, but we shared everything. We did everything together. We shared a dinner jacket. We had the one dinner jacket, and if there was some special occasion, some ball or something, then one of us wore it, and we were saving up for the trousers too. And we shared a car. We had one of those clapped-out cars. When you knew who was the driver or the owner of the car, he was the one who, when you got in, leant across you and re-slammed the door. It was that sort of car. And once, when it was my turn to borrow our car, I was driving home and stopped at traffic lights, and suddenly I heard strange little sort of squeaks and noises at my feet. And I looked down, and the floor was covered in minute little furry things, all going eep, 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 eep. Field mice. So I ran the car into a side street, looked underneath, and there was a whole colony of plump little furry field mice. Yes, very sweet, Dillis, I quite agree. But they had dug a little nest underneath the passenger seat of our car, and there they had stored... That little sort of hole in the passenger seat was like a sort of mouse Dorchester hotel. They had all sorts of crumbs, old pie crusts, and lots of remnants of those biscuits with dried flies in them, you know, like Garibaldi's. And something suddenly clicked into my mind that when Dennis had the car, he must have been eating. I realised what had happened, that I had a partner who was an addict. It was terrible. He was a nibbling addict, a nibbler. What do you do about it? I mean, how do you stop him? How to nobble a nibbler? I resolved to have it out with him. And we were there sitting there thinking that following afternoon.
and he was chewing his fountain pen and sucking his tie, and I was humming, dung, 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 dung. And I suddenly said, I know your secret, Den. He paled. He went livid, a vivid livid. I said, you're a compulsive nibbler. You're a Garibaldi Ollick. He said, mayn't a man nibble a bicky on his way home? And I said, it isn't quite that, is it? And I leant across the desk, and I whisked the fountain pen out of his breast pocket, the black fountain pen, passed it lightly between my nose, a stick of licorice. I reached forward, tugged at his thin, pale green tie. Not a tie at all. Lasagna. I strode round this whimpering figure, whipped the pigskin wallet out of his pocket that he toyed with. An elderly, cold cheese omelette. And I don't shake your head, Dennis. It's absolutely true, and I'm sorry to have to bring this up, but if you don't believe me, well, come outside, and I have evidence. I'd hoped I would never have to say this sentence of Rose Fileman, but there are furries at the bottom of our car, Den.
Well, that's the sad end of a beautiful friendship, and we'll go on to Dennis. And your quotation, Dennis, which comes from a popular song sung, I think, by Doris Day, is Once I Had a Secret Love.
When I was listening to Frank holding my eating habits up to public ridicule, it made me think about food. In fact, it set me thinking back nostalgically to some of the things that my generation used to eat in our childhood that have completely disappeared from the scene now. The price of a side of lamb today, it couldn't be more expensive if Noah had only taken one sheep into the oven. We're rapidly approaching the stage when meat eating as such could become solely a spectator sport. So I said, I'm going to renounce it. From today, I have ceased to be a carnivore. Look it up. He said, well, what will you eat? I said, well, I'll exist on food that doesn't contain any meat. And he said, you can't live on sausages. I stuck to my guns, however, and that is how I got on to this thing called the health food kick. Now, you can only obtain these foodstuffs in certain designated establishments. I know, because I tried to get some in the BBC canteen, but when I asked the waitress, could I please have a plate of raw carrots, raw cabbage and watercress, she said, I'm sorry, this is a restaurant, not a meadow. which means, in effect, that one has to frequent places called health food restaurants. Now, there are quite a few of these around London. What I couldn't stomach was the concept of vegetable matter posing as meat. Do you know what I mean? Like vegetables in drag, as it were. Because when it comes to items like soya bean steaks or lentil cutlets, there is a basic fact of human nature that you just cannot fight. That is the only way, the only real way to enjoy a meatless meat pie is to have tasteless taste buds. And that's what really made me split from the health food scene. And I did give it a fair trial. It was a full two meals that I had, but the specific dish that sent me back to animal flesh was this. Seated one day at the organic, I'd just finished my firsts, the first course. I turned to my main course. Now, do you know what that turned out to be? Fried German cabbage got up to look for all the world like a meat loaf. As for taste, I can only tell you, one bite of it, and I was round at the tinned meat shop before you could say monosodium glutamate. So that, then, is what drove me away and out of the health food fold. Fried German cabbage in meatloaf form. Or, as the song has it, once I ate a sauerkraut loaf.
Poor Dennis does have a terrible time, and we'll now have a look at the score, if we can find it. The whole contest is a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.